Hey there, this is Alex Lokes, and welcome to the November episode of Classic Camera Revival. And as we get further into winter, it's the perfect time for the photographer to go into hibernation. And I don't mean sleeping, I mean escaping into our basements, sheds, and various other dark spaces to start printing all the film we shot the year before. So this month on CCR, we are seeing red, and that doesn't mean we're getting angry.
I'm being left in the dark.
Coming to you live from Toronto, Canada, this is the Classic Camera Revival. If you don't have gear acquisition syndrome now, you certainly will after listening to our show.
Okay, and this is just going to be a random show here. Basically, anything in the dark room is up for chatting about. So, whoever wants to get us started, let's hear it.
Okay, dark room. I tend to print seasonally in both the sort of because I ski in the winter. So, usually the weekends from roughly about Christmas time to like in a March break, I'm on the slopes. So I don't really print in the winter because I usually go to bed early. But in spring and fall, I'm in the darkroom printing, and my usual gear of choice, I've got two enlargers, a big-ass Devir 504 with a condenser head with big monster crystals, which I still need to find one for 120. I'm currently using 4x5 as kind of like the stopgap. And my other one is an autofocus Leitz V35, which is really cool. And it's actually the perfect enlarger for those who live in smaller houses, condominiums, apartments, because you can improvise your bathroom into a dark room, and you can still move in and out. Whereas the Devir is, it's a boat anchor.
So, what makes the Leitz V35 so good? I mean, like I've never heard of an autofocus enlarger before.
This is the thing. It is a lovely piece of engineering, and it only prints 35mm. So I remember shooting. I shot a roll of off my Pentax Spotmatic F a few years back, and I threw a neg of I think it was like a Land Rover Defender or something, and threw it in, and it was like literally I did not have to touch up the focusing. It just locked right in and go bang, done. It is a color head. So you got to have a nice little chart to kind of dial in the equivalent of your standard Ilford filters.
Well, that's good.
Which is great. You can get that resource actually off the Ilford Photo website. That's what I did. They recently revamped their website. So you might have to hunt around a bit. But other than that, I have to print more.
Well, and your prints are spectacular. My wife and I have that beautiful print that you made of us.
Why, thank you.
And we absolutely love it.
Yeah, so paper-wise, I used to print with a lot of fiber. Now I'm just, maybe I'm getting my aging ever so closer to 50. I'm saying, screw it, I'm just going to go RC and keep it simple. So I tend to go with Ilford Multigrade and Kentmere. Kentmere is actually a really nice paper. It's fast as all get out. Mm. Very contrasty. So you're going to have to adjust your times.
Yep.
So you got to experiment a little bit to start with. Do some test prints, some test exposures. But again, it's one that, again, it's also made by Harman, which is Ilford Photo. You get great paper to work with. I do want to try FOMA papers at some point.
I have used FOMA paper. Actually, I have some 11x14 languishing in my dark room, which has unfortunately been reverted back to a storage closet. I need to get that cleared out this winter and get printing again. But I really like the FOMA paper. Again, like you, I've never gotten into fiber paper simply because I don't have the capability of washing it the same or letting it or the equipment to actually make it flat. So RC paper, if you're just getting into darkroom printing, RC paper or resin coat is definitely the way to go. It is incredibly much more forgiving, and the Ilford stuff is a great, easy way to start off with.
And the other thing with RC papers, I think historically everyone went with fiber for longevity. Mm. But the resin-coated paper technology has come light years ahead. So it's a bit of a wash. Like, purists will love fiber for just the tonality. And again, at some point I want to grab like a box of 8x10 glossy fiber from Ilford and just say, okay, fine, I'll just do a series with this for kicks right. and giggles. In terms of flattening, like, I generally print as big as I go to 11x14, and my usual go-to is a couple of coffee table books in a few weeks.
Yeah, that works.
That's what I do, like, for flattening 11x14. I've got this big Ansel Adams coffee book. I keep hoping the brilliance will...
Osmosis?
Yeah. Soak through.
And then a big box of dead batteries.
That works too.
Yeah.
And 48 hours, it's flat enough to frame.
Oh, nice. I'll have to give that a shot as soon as I've run through all my existing paper stocks. I've used FOMA, Ilford, and even Kodak paper. Now, Kodak sadly no longer makes paper, but the paper they did produce was absolutely fantastic. Mm-hmm. And
and fast.
Yeah.
Really fast coming up.
Mm-hmm.
Well, interestingly, Berger has launched some new papers, and those will be interesting to try.
Definitely.
So we'll see how that goes out. I think it's been a while for me since I printed in the darkroom. I'm in the process of getting my new darkroom set up. So I have 3 enlargers.
Sounds like me.
Yeah, I have more enlargers than I have room for. But I've got a big Bessler 4x5 enlarger with the cold light on top.
Oh, that sounds very similar.
Yeah, and I have an Omega B22, and I have a Dichoric, a Saunders LPL 6700 for doing some color. Personally, when I'm doing black and white, I try to stay away from dichroic color heads. I just find that condenser enlargers just get a little bit better contrast when it comes to black and white, in my experience. Definitely. You know, in terms of the dark room itself and setting it up, there's a few principles that, you know, I think you need to stick by. Main one is have a separate wet area and a separate dry area.
Yep.
Figure out what kind of light you want in there. Do you want to have a red light, or do you want to go with the sodium light? Personally, I prefer the sodium light because you can leave it on the whole time. Basically the sodium, the wavelength of the sodium light is essentially equivalent to the wavelength of the red light, so the papers are not good, and it's a yellow light. Those of you who are listening from Toronto probably remember years ago the Gardner Expressway was illuminated by sodium lights. An interesting fact: the reason it was done that way because Toronto was so close to the our international airport here, their safety concern at the time was they didn't want planes landing on the highway, which was strange, but.
Question: where can you get these sodium bulbs? Are they can you go into a standard light bulb?
No. So these were specifically made for dark rooms. Okay. So I've acquired one on Kijiji. For those in the States, it's kind of like another version of Craigslist. Although we do have Craigslist up here in Canada, but I found a guy that through an estate sale had acquired a bunch of darkroom gear. And I managed to snag a nice timer and a sodium light from him. So, good segue into timers. I have an Omega electronic timer with a foot pedal.
That sounds exactly like mine, and it beeps.
And it beeps. So I think that's, a great thing to have. It just, usually, like, these days you're working in the darkroom by yourself. So the less, opportunity to get your hands dirty and dusty and that sort of thing. And use a foot pedal and have a safe LED readout on the time is fantastic. A couple of other things that, as far as the darkroom go, that I really like to use. My eyesight is horrendous when it comes to seeing things up close and small. I can see anything 500 feet away, but put that 6 inches in front of me, I won't be able to tell you what it is. So I really do think Mike is a good looking guy until he walks away. So.
Ow! Ooh.
Sorry, Mike.
It's all good.
Time,
but I use a Patterson microfocus finder for making sure the grain is actually in focus. And that's a really neat little tool to use. So, you know, basically it looks like a microscope. You focus your image, you put it right under the main lens of the enlarger, and then you just adjust your enlarger focus until you can actually see the grains in focus with a check line that runs across the field of the scope.
And a tip with those, they are so sensitive that you want to focus with a piece of paper, like a scrap piece of paper, in the easel. Don't focus on the easel surface itself because there's a difference, even though the paper's thin.
Absolutely, You do account for the thickness of the paper. Use an old stock, a contact print or something like that. Yeah. Flip it over.
Yeah. I just use an old piece of photo paper and just do that.
So the thing in the darkroom too, not just on the dry side, the print side, you know, the wet side, the developing is obviously, you know, very much a big part of the darkroom. Most of us don't do it in the traditionally in the darkroom anymore, but one cool little thing that I found on B&H the other day, and I started developing my own C41 at home recently, and C41, DIY C41 is new to me. And you know, what I found is, like, with black and white, I usually, the last thing I do is I do a little dip and dunk with the photo flow in some distilled water, and I can hang my black and white negatives to dry, and the surfactant effect, the, you know, the water dispersion, I don't get any spots. But with C41, after the stabilizer, I didn't have a squeegee. I used to use, in my older days, my younger days, now it's, I'm in my older days, I used to use a rubber bladed squeegee that I always felt scratched. The negatives.
They can.
Yeah.
They can.
So I have found a Yankee squeegee from B&H called, it's a Yankee squeegee. I guess it's squeegees Yankees. And it's
don't think about it too hard.
Yeah. Yeah. Try not to think about it. But it's got two sponge pads. Two soft sponge pads on the to squeeze the Yankees.
I'm playing with your doodle.
Oh my God. At least it's not your noodle.
First you Yankee, then you squeegee.
Anyway.
Moving right along. So, James.
Moving right along.
James, so I'd say you can use that with black and white negatives.
Yes, well. And you can use it, and it's 4 inches wide, so you can use it on your 4x5 sheet film as well. That's so nice. What I plan to do with this is I'm going to, before I dump my stabilizer from doing C41, I'm going to dip it in the tank.
Yep.
Soak the sponges in the stabilizer, and then I will squeegee my C41. And same thing, I have a separate one for black and white that gets dipped into the photo flow solution.
Well, one of the things I found is adding a bit of photo flow actually to the stabilizer.
Yes, I've done a bit of research on that as well. Now, you know, stabilizer, the whole reason of stabilizer is to not allow fungus and organic matter to start consuming your film. From what I could find, and of course this is praying to the gods of the internet, so I went and go-ogled it. And that's what Google means, go-ogle, people. So if you... Yeah. So I did that, and I couldn't find any definitive information on whether or not adding photo flow to your stabilizer solution, you know, caused any ill effects to the stabilizer or not.
In the past 5 years that I've, the last time that I did C41, I did it back in 2012, and my negatives from 2012 that I did it with the photo flow in the stabilizer, not a problem. Not a problem. Even the stabilizer I still have, and there's nothing growing in it. There's no little white blobs floating in it. It's actually still pretty clear.
Okay.
Nice.
Great. And so, you know, just a quick note on this squeegee. Do not use it dry.
No.
It must be wet. Otherwise, it is sandpaper.
Yep.
And if you do E6, get a third one.
Mm.
Yeah.
Definitely keep everything separate. The one thing that I started doing, in fact, the very first time I started printing, and this goes back to the longevity, is toning my images.
That's where you need fiber.
Actually, the RC works really well. Again, what toning does is it actually works in it's pure chemistry, because it basically does a chemical swap. replaces the silver crystals with selenium crystals, which aren't sensitive to light. When I first started printing, I noticed that, and it probably could have been because I wasn't fixing long enough or fixing enough or had too dilute fixer, that most of those early prints are now black, right? You can't see, you can see some details in the highlights, but other than that, all the shadows are gone. But since I started toning my prints, not only do my prints look better when they're behind glass and hung on the wall, they don't go black anymore because they've lost that. I haven't tried any other types of toning, like gold toning or sepia toning, because it is one of the more expensive chemicals to get, but it does last long because you don't do it in high dilutions, you do it in very light dilutions. And again, this came to me from Matt Marosh, who put together this beautiful video on toning and how he tones. And I basically based mine on that and then tweaked it to what I need. I recently was able to finally put some of my own darkroom prints up on the wall in my condo. And it just like, hey, look, these are mine. It's just a pride thing seeing your own art up on the wall in the place you live.
I might jump in and just talk about fixer for a second. You're saying that that's a, you know, fixer is one of those chemicals that if you don't deal with it properly, you can really mess up not only your prints and your film. And the one thing about fixer is you really have to be religious about not using exhausted fixer.
Yes.
And so there's this little, the stuff that I like to use, it comes in a tiny bottle. I think it's called Edwell Hypocheck. And it's basically all you do is you put a drop in your hypo, in your fixer, and if it turns white, it means replace your fixer. If it's clear, it means your fixer is still good. It's as simple as that. You got a tiny little bottle that will last forever, and I can't imagine, like, either if you don't do something like that, you are either, you know, getting rid of your fixer too early and spending an awful lot of money that you don't have to, or worse, you're hanging out, you're using it too long, and like you might think you're especially with film, it will make you think your negatives have been fixed, but they really haven't.
No.
Look at those negatives in a few months and you'll wonder where your pictures went.
Yep. Absolutely.
Maybe I'll continue on sort of a film theme. Now, before I start this, you know, there are some certain eternal debates, religious debates in photography. Film versus digital, Nikon versus Canon. The one I'm going to talk about is steel reels versus plastic reels. Now, I'm a fan of steel reels, especially for medium format. But for 35 millimeter, like, not all steel reels are created equal. You can get some really cheap ass ones out there. And so I've got a couple examples of ones that I only use if I have to, and one that I quite like. The one that I don't use is, I think it's like no name brand. You know, I got it for a couple of bucks off eBay, and it's sort of hard to see, you know, you can't hear it because you have to get the film to clip into the middle as a little,
right.
Like, I forget what you would call this. It bends.
It's a clip.
A retainer clip.
Retainer, yeah. And it's easy to do on a 120. I find the 35, because it's narrower, is difficult. Now, the other kind of steel reel it doesn't have a clip. What it does is it has the two little prongs. And what you can do with this is, instead of having to try to clip the film in the middle, you hook the perforations of a 35 millimeter film on into this, and it is so much easier as long as you get the film even, so you're not, you know,
right,
slanted one way or another. So I think these are Hughes, British made.
Yeah.
So if you're going to go 35 millimeter steel, I would go with a name brand, because, the cheap steel reels are just an exercise and frustration. Also, if you drop them and they get bent, loading becomes an exercise in frustration. Now, having said that, I do have some plastic reels, so I'm not going to go all religious on it. You know, whatever works for you, but for me, I like steel.
Yeah. One question about steel reels and tanks: are they light tight? Can they be used in daylight? And I, And I simply ask because one of the things I eventually want to do is put together a World War II combat photographer impression from the Canadian Film and Photo Unit. And one of the things I want to be able to do is demonstrate film developing in the field as just something like this is what people had to do, right? You didn't just load it onto your computer and send it over the wire, right? You would send your film back to a lab in London and they would develop the film for you. They wouldn't probably do it in the field, but just as a little extra view for people, especially the younger audience at timeline events, just something to do. Could I use a steel tank in the field?
I've had no problems with steel tanks being light tight. There are a couple of different kinds of lids. You'll find
right.
There are the steel lids.
Yep.
And the Kinderman.
And I find that the steel ones can be a bit leaky.
Okay.
Like chemical leaky, not light leaky.
Right.
And then the plastic lids, the black plastic.
Right.
They don't look as cool as the all metal, but right. I prefer them. But again, with either a plastic or a metal lid, as long as you haven't bent it or something, I've had no light leak issues with steel tanks.
Good to know.
The only thing I've had a problem with steel tanks is with the steel lids is the fact that if while you're inverting it, if you don't quite have a good grip on it, your lid actually can slip off, and I have had that happen once or twice.
Well, I think that's just... You make a good point. I haven't thought about it because I just do it without thinking. I always have a overhand grip. And also, let's say if it's a large tank with with a lot of film in it. Let's say if I'm doing three rolls or of 120 or something, I am agitating with both hands, one on top, one on the bottom, because all it takes is a little slip. Yep. The lid can pop off. And, of course, it'll never happen at the fixer stage. It'll always happen at the development stage.
Or the stop.
Exactly.
Yeah, the other thing with the black plastic lids is be really careful because as the plastic ages and gets brittle, it can crack, which will, of course, lead to light leaks, which I've had.
Now, when it comes to developers in the darkroom, what is everyone's favorite? Because I've mostly used Dektal. Yeah, but there's
Dektal here as well.
We're talking paper developers.
Dektal.
Well, you can develop Triax in Dektal. I did that as a teenager, and you get some interesting results. Exactly fine grain. I tend to use the Ilford multigrade, but back high school in the 70s, it was Dektal.
Dektal is
it's pretty much the gold standard for paper developers.
It's like the D76.
Exactly.
Of paper. It's a good place to start. Nice. It's a vanilla, neutral developer.
Oh, absolutely.
Great way to get your chops down and learn how to do it. And then you can start playing with them.
The one I simply ask because one developer that I eventually want to try is Ansco 130. And that's one that, again, I'd have to mix up from raw chemicals. No problems here.
Actually, I've messed, is everyone familiar with Photographer's Formulae, that specialty chemical company way out?
Yes.
Yep.
The U.S. Planes. They actually make a kit. Version of Ansco 130. I bought it from B&H a few years back, mixed it up. So literally... Unlike, say, Dektal, where you just cut the envelope, dump the envelope into the water, stir, make sure the water's hot. The 130, literally, it's each component chemical. So literally, I just laid out from left to right. This is the process. You put the chemicals in each stage so you don't mess it up. Mm-hmm. Other than that, it's a nice print developer.
Yeah.
It actually has a longer lifespan, I think, than Dektal.
Yeah. I just ask, it was Ansel Adams. Developer of choice, and he always seems to know the best stuff. So it doesn't guarantee that my shots will be Ansel Adams material, but who wants to duplicate a famous photographer anyways?
Exactly, right?
One combination I like, although I haven't really done a lot of printing recently, again, it's back problems, but anyway, enough about my health, is a combination of the Ilford warm tone, like fiber-based, paper and the warm tone developer.
Yes.
It's a subtle effect. It's not like looking at rusty brown.
Right.
But it just, I think for portrait work, it just gives that added little touch, which is really, really nice. But it does oxidize fairly quickly.
Yeah.
That's what I found with a lot of Ilford's multi-grade print developer, and also it's their liquid, not their DDX, but definitely their Ilfasol 3.
Oh, yeah, big time.
That oxidizes within 2 weeks when you open that, and it's frustrating. Love the results, but yeah, I can't buy it, and then it's like, oh wow, 2 weeks later it's already brown.
Yeah, you kind of need a really, really fast workflow when you're working with like Ilfasol 3
or a batch of a healthy backlog of film to do.
Yeah.
Just do it.
It's
all
like
at once.
A one shot deal, and when you finish the jug, you rinse it out and pop it in the blue box.
Yep.
Now, I'd like to also touch base as far as like what James was mentioning about sodium lamps. I happen to come across some LED red bulbs, and they're a lot easier to find than sodium lamps now today, obviously, since everything's now switching to LEDs. And I actually have tried these LED red bulbs in my darkroom. I've screwed it in. I took a sheet of paper, and I pretty much held it right against the bulb for a good couple minutes, tossed it in the developer just to see what happened. Nothing.
Oh,
stayed completely
beautiful.
Blank.
Oh, that's great.
And the bulb is super bright, so it's very. It lights up the room really nicely.
Yeah.
And since it's only giving off red light, the paper is completely blind to it.
Absolutely.
And I did a double check of this yesterday, actually, when I was developing some Svema Blue, or it's a yellow film, but it's blue light sensitive. I'm downstairs in my favorite tank to use, which is the Agfa Rondinex 35U. Phenomenal tank to use. Pop the lid off to inspect the negatives while they're developing.
Right.
Held it up to the light just to inspect them and...
Nothing.
Keep going with the developer right under the red light. Absolutely nothing. And I've used
beautiful.
A red light such as the good compact fluorescent spirals. They give off so much UV light, as soon as the paper sees it, that's it. It's just going to go black.
It's gone, yeah. No, darkroom work is, it's fun, it's incredibly rewarding, but you really have to be in the right state of mind to be able to do that, because you do lose track of time. I've gone into darkroom at like 9 o'clock at night, and next thing you know, it's 3 a.m.
Yeah, that's what happens. I usually start it around 8:30, 9 o'clock at night on a cold November's Saturday evening, and then I just put on one of my Spotify playlists, and
yep.
I just lose track of time.
Oh, yeah. Nothing like music to help work through it. That about covers it for this show. We are coming up at the end of this season, but don't worry, we will be back for season 4. So if you have any idea of a topic or a camera system you'd like us to cover, by all means, you can reach out to us. Our social media contacts and email address are all found on our episode notes. And I'm Alex Laux, and I think I'm going to go hibernate in the darkroom for a while.
I'm James Lee. Photography is like sex. They both develop in the dark.
Well, you sort of stole my joke. So this is John Meadows. Who knew how much fun you could have in a dark room by yourself?
This is Donna Bataxi. Keep that film rolling.
This is Mike Bataxi. And for once, James definitely takes the cake, and I got nothing witty to say.
This is Bill Smith. And yes, I'm going to echo. James, I got nothing. I'm sorry. I just got nothing this month.
Inappropriate Saturdays.